If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Hi, I'm Tom Butler.
And I'm Brendan Duffy.
You're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us on this journey of discovery across the world of the 007 movies as we take an encyclopedic look at cinema's greatest spy films.
We'll learn about the people who made them in front of the camera and behind, from Ken Adam to Mac Zorin, with the occasional detour down a few rabbit holes. And we'll sometimes be joined by guests with unique insight into the world of Bond.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the James Bond brand, Eon, or the Fleming Estate. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we do get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us on podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. Oi, 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 and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast, where we have reached the letter O. My name is Tom Butler, and joining me as we take a look at things from the world of James Bond movies that fall under the 15th letter of the alphabet, it's the observant and offbeat Mr. Brendan Duffy.
Oi, oi, Savaloy.
it's a bit of a strange letter in the alphabet. It hasn't got many entries in the world of Bond, unfortunately, so we're widening our remit a little bit on this episode. We've got a few Bond characters, a couple of oblique oddities, and in the coming weeks we'll have episodes on Octopussy and on Her Majesty's Secret Service to look out for. Excited to do both of those. How about you?
Obviously. That's the only
obviously.
O I can think of.
Very good. Very good. So just a reminder that for our upcoming anniversary episode in October, we're going to be calling out for the your underappreciated James Bond movie moments. So we want you to email your thoughts on the Bond movie moments that you feel is underappreciated, that you want to shine a light on. Email a recording of yourself explaining who you are, what the moment is, and why in under 2 minutes, and email it to podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk, and we will compile the best entries into a episode to release around the 60th anniversary in October. I'm aware that we record our episodes a little bit in advance, but Brendan, did you see the news that it's going to be at least 2 years until we get Bond 26?
I did indeed.
And what do you think?
Oh, well, I'm not really surprised. I think that was what was expected. But obviously when it's confirmed, it does make your heart sink a little.
It does feel like a long, long way away, doesn't it? But it's not nowhere near as long as we waited for No Time to Die, and that was achievable. But
yeah.
I saw a lot of people getting upset or sort of being confused by the idea that they would be reinventing Bond for Bond 26. But surely they reinvent Bond every movie.
At the very least, they reinvent Bond at least once every actor changes.
Yeah,
so, exactly. Roger Moore went through two changes of the direction they went in.
Yeah.
Connery, he probably did three.
Yep.
I'm not surprised by that at all. I'd be shocked if they tried to continue it, what they were doing, to be honest.
Well, I mean, the sheer sake that it would be physically impossible for them to carry on as they were, because James Bond is dust, isn't he? But but you know, 2 years is something that they said in an event, probably in a crowded bar, and so I don't think you can take everything that is said in those circumstances as gospel. I think were it to come down to MGM and Amazon, I think they might want to move things further along, but it just really depends on there's lots of different factors at play. That's what I'm trying to say. So I think maybe, you know, 2 years is probably about right. But I would be surprised if they didn't have someone lined up to play Bond already. But what do I know?
I mean, yeah, it would be surprising that they've sat there during the whole pandemic and the last, when did the film come out? 8 months ago? 9 months ago? For them to sit there and not have thought about it at all, to be honest.
No, But anyway, back to the letter O. So to kick things off, let's head back to 1964, take a look at the greatest Bond henchman of all time.
Absolutely. And we did talk about him a little bit in the Goldfinger episode, but O is for Oddjob, played by Harold Sakata. So Oddjob is the bodyguard, the chauffeur, caddy. Has he got another job role? I think that's everything he does for Goldfinger.
Ball crusher.
Yeah, ball crusher. I mean, hitman. Yeah, yeah. He's got it all, hasn't he? He's probably the ideal henchman, isn't he? He's the man you would want. You know, he's strong. He's got throwing skills. He's loyal.
And he doesn't talk.
He doesn't talk. Yeah,
can't talk back.
So and his interactions with Bond are very good. So I think the first time we see him, he's. It's at the hotel when he knocks Bond out. Bond goes to the fridge to get some more champagne and knocks Bond out and he kills Jill Masterson. I assume he's the one who covers her in gold paint. And then they meet again at the golf match. Is it a match? What do you call it? A golf game?
Yeah, golf game. It's a golf. Yeah.
Yeah. So they meet during the golf
game. It's a round of golf, isn't it?
That's the word I was looking for. A round of golf. So the round of golf that they have, Oddjob is the caddy for Goldfinger, and he assists him in essentially cheating. But Bond is a bit shrewd about it all and swaps the balls so that in the end Bond has to win due to the club rules. This is where he gets quite angry. Oddjob, you know, shows off his skills. Goldfinger tells him to just points at the statue, doesn't he? And he lobs his hat at the statue and knocks its head off. And then this is where he crushes his golf ball, which is not actually physically possible, but it's still an impressive feat on screen. Kills Tilly Masterson, so he kills both of them, doesn't he? Both of the Masterson sisters. This time he throws a hat at Tilly. Oh, he drives the guy. Who's the guy that refuses, the gangster? What's his name? The one who's not interested.
Solo?
Solo, is that's it, Solo? It. Yeah, Solo. He doesn't want to take part in Goldfinger's scheme. So Oddjob then takes him out and crushes him in the car, puts him in the crusher.
Well, Goldfinger just kills all the others anyway.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah. So you get special treatment.
Yeah. Well, maybe he just, that's what he likes to do. He's a big fan of the crusher. And then at the end, the one thing I remember is Oddjob coming down those steps. It takes him ages to come down the steps, doesn't it? He comes down the steps and then he has a fight with Bond, and the way that Bond finally defeats him is by electrocuting him. And we spoke about this in the Goldfinger episode, that after that shoot, Harold actually held on and really badly burnt his hands, and Guy Hamilton was shouting cut, and he just carried on holding them. They were, yeah, badly burnt after that, so he was dedicated to the job. So loyal actor as well as a loyal henchman,
and one of the great Bond henchman battles, I think.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, because it's one of them where you see, had it have gone on and that not happened, Bond would have lost.
Yeah,
which is what you want from a henchman, a real sense of threat and peril. So in terms of the character Oddjob,
sorry, just to interject, taking it back to the knick-knack question, is his name Mr. Job, first name Odd?
Ooh,
or I mean, is he's he, never? Or has he got? It's a, never explained, is it?
No, it's not. Odd, Mr. Odd Job. Well, the thing is his name is spelt as one word.
That's true.
So, has he got a name that we don't know of? A first name? Is it Mr. Odd Job?
Who knows?
Or is it? This one seems like a nickname, doesn't it? Odd Job.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems more like the man who can do everything, right? It's a good name,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. He's such a popular henchman that he's in loads of video games. He's in the James Bond 007. He's in GoldenEye Rogue Agent, GoldenEye 007, 007 Nightfire, and the original GoldenEye. But they made him really short in GoldenEye on the N64. Since that came out, the people who made the game actually said that he was a cheat character. So if you picked him because he was so short and you couldn't shoot him, you know, you could just run around and do what you want if you were played as him.
It was an unfair advantage, wasn't it?
Yeah, but really popular character played by Harold Sakata, who was born in 1920 and he was an American Olympic weightlifter. also a wrestler, and then an actor. And he won a silver medal for the US in the 1948 Summer Olympics for weightlifting. So his full name was Toshiyuki Sakata, and he adopted his more Western name, Harold, when he was a teenager. And prior to Goldfinger, he'd never acted before. But because the character was considered to be mute, this meant that it didn't really rely on much acting, and he could just focus on his physicality. But before he actually got the role of Oddjob, a former wrestler, Milton Reed, who was also an actor, he auditioned for the role. And he challenged Sakata for a wrestling contest, and whoever won would get the role.
Well, it doesn't sound very union friendly, does it?
No, it doesn't. So it didn't go ahead because Milton Reed had already been in Dr. No, and that character had been killed off. So they decided to go with Sakata. But Milton Reed did get to be in another Bond film. He played Sandor in The Spy Who Loved Me.
Yes, of course.
So Sakata also was in other films. So Jaws, in The Jaws of Death in 1976 and The Happy Hooker Goes to Washington in 1977, he was credited as Harold Oddjob Sakata in the actual film credits. So much, you know, that the role had become his, and he was like sort of more Oddjob than Harold Sakata at this point. But Guy Hamilton said about him, he said he's an absolutely charming man and he had a very unique way of moving. So in creating Oddjob, he used all of Harold's own characteristics. And he does, he kind of, he glides, doesn't he? It's like a, like a robotic glide. It's hard to explain. I've never seen anyone move like it.
No.
Which that's probably what makes that fight with Bond so interesting, because they're both about moving.
It's graceful, isn't
it? There, that's graceful. And you've got the way Bond moves. It's very interesting visually. So he also appeared as Oddjob in the TV adverts for Vicks cough syrup, which we did talk right. about. This is where Oddjob has got a horrible cough and he is destroying everything around him. And the cure is some Vicks formula, and that stops him lashing out. Sakata, he actually died 4 weeks after his 62nd birthday in 1982. But he did make one final appearance a few months before at the 54th Academy Awards, coming on stage as Oddjob, while Sheena Easton sang For Your Eyes Only.
I didn't realise it was just before he died. It's one something we've talked about a few times, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sad.
So yeah, that was Harold Sakata. And then I just wanted to touch on one more thing. And this is about the hat. So in 2020, a guy went on Antiques Roadshow and he had his bowler hat that he had valued at £30,000. So it was one of the original bowler hats from the film. The guy who owns it said he was a big Bond fan as a kid, and his brother-in-law was a driver for Aston Martin during the filming of Goldfinger. Mm. And he asked Pinewood if they had any memorabilia. So they gave him one of Oddjob's bowler hats, but they took out the metal rim. Which, that makes sense, doesn't it, if you're giving it to some kids, essentially. So he said, as a young lad, everyone wanted to throw the Oddjob hat. And if you look at it, everybody did throw the hat because it's absolutely in pieces because it didn't have the steel in it anymore. So therefore, whenever it landed, it damaged it.
Oh.
So there's, yeah, you can Google it and it really has been battered. But the guy who, one of the presenters on Antiques Roadshow, Mark Allam, said he was shaking with anticipation and excitement over seeing the hat. So the other hats, there's one that the James Bond fan club in 1998, they had possession of one of Oddjob's hats and it was auctioned off at Christie's and it got £62,000, but it was in much better condition than the Welsh one. And there's another one as well that went for auction for $36,000, and that was one from the estate of Harold Sakata. So there's at least three hats floating around. Maybe it's time to check in your attics and see if you if you've got an Oddjob hat lying around. But yeah, so an iconic henchman, probably the iconic henchman. Him and Jaws are probably the top two, aren't they?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's just well, we've talked about it before about him being the he's just the living embodiment of the sort of ideal henchman. He's physically unique.
Yeah.
He's menacing. He seems to enjoy his job. All of these attributes that I think make for the perfect perfect foil for Bond. Someone that's physically able to match him. And it's just been done many, many, many times since. And I was watching Octopussy, and I think is it Govinda? And he crushes the dice in the casino. So it's just something that lives on, isn't it?
Yeah, and Hinks as well.
Hinks very much in the Odd Job mold, doesn't talk.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, just an absolute icon, definitely one of the all-timers. When you see the greatest hits of Bond clips, Odd Job is definitely in there.
Yeah.
I did read that Mythbusters did a episode where they proved that you wouldn't actually be able to decapitate a statue with Odd Job's hat, which is a shame. But
yeah, but I'm not surprised by that result.
But talk about the clothes and the memorabilia and checking in your cupboard. Did you see that? Oh, this is completely off topic, but there was a dress from The Wizard of Oz that had been found in a shoebox in a school. And it's going to be auctioned for like $1 million or something.
Wow.
It literally had just been left lying around in a shoebox, and they were about to throw it out, and they thought, I'll just check in here, see what it is. And it was a dress from Wizard of Oz. So these things do get found many years later.
Yes.
Well, Wizard of Oz, didn't think we'd get there today, but there you have it. I've got to go somewhere else completely weird now as well. So on to the next section. Oh, it's for OK Connery. So, as I mentioned in the intro, I said we'd be going somewhere a little bit beyond where we usually cover. And I obviously wasn't kidding, but OK Connery, which is also known as Operation Kid Brother, is an Italian spy spoof that was released in 1967 that has many, many crossovers with the world of James Bond, most notably in that it stars Sean Connery's younger brother, Neil Connery, as a secret agent. Well, he's not really a secret agent. I'll explain as we go along. Have you seen this movie, Brendan?
No, and I know very limited about it, to be honest, so I'm looking forward to this.
It is bizarre. I mean, it's very... It's very much a cash-in type movie. It's very sort of shoddily made. But it is impressive how Bond-like it is due to all the different connections. So, I mean, the general story, or the story goes for OK Connery, is that Sean Connery's younger brother, Neil, who was 8 years Big Tams Jr., was a plasterer in the 1960s, while his older brother was becoming this global megastar, thanks to the James Bond film. So when Neil Connery lost his tools, his plastering tools, or perhaps they were stolen, I'm not quite sure on the details on that, but he lost his tools and then he lost his job subsequently from it. And so when his union took up the case, he then started to do a lot of press around it. So they were looking to get justice for him as a labourer. And because he was Sean Connery's brother, everyone wanted to interview him. So he did a lot of interviews talking about his story. And coincidentally, Terence Young, who was a director on a number of James Bond films, Dr. No and From Russia With Love's Thunderball, etc., he heard Neil Connery on the radio and he realised, obviously, how much he sounded like Sean Connery. So he told an Italian producer friend of his called Dario Sabatello. Now, Sabatello was a opportunistic filmmaker, let's say. He was at the time making spaghetti westerns, those sorts of things, on the cheap in Italy. And so with Bond mania, spy mania at its height, this guy Dario travelled to Edinburgh to meet Neil Connery, and he agreed to pay him $5,000 to star in a spy spoof. So he's got Neil Connery. It's the closest he's going to get to Sean Connery. Although he does try and get Sean Connery in the movie, but Connery's
not for $5,000.
Definitely not for $5,000. That wouldn't pay for his toupees, would it? he manages to recruit, and this is amazing because you would not get this nowadays, but he manages to recruit Bernard Lee and Lois Maxwell to be in the film. He also hires Anthony Dawson, who was obviously in Dr. No. We've got Daniela Bianchi, who was in From Russia With Love, and also Adolfo Celli from Thunderball. And interestingly, Adolfo Celli, he plays sort of like the main villain, but he wears a monocle obviously, where Largo in Thunderball wears an eye patch. So it's all very like referencing Bond. There's also a sort of a female assassin who looks a lot like Rosa Klebb as well. And her name's Lottie Krayendorf, who, and the actor that played Rosa Klebb was called Lottie Lenya. So Neil Connery in the movie plays a plastic surgeon. The plot is so weird and complicated. I don't really want to try and explain it, but he gets recruited by Bernard Lee's Commander Cunningham to help take down this guy, Mr. Ty, who's played by Adolfo Celli, because he's got a device that freezes anything with moving metal parts. And the thing with Neil Connery, is that he's an expert archer, so he doesn't have to rely on guns. It's weird, I told you. So one of the bizarre things about OK Connery is that they hired Neil Connery because he looks like Sean Connery a bit, but he sounds a lot like Sean Connery. But what they actually did is when they dubbed the movie, they had an American dub over Neil Connery, so they don't even get his voice.
What?
Yeah, and for a lot of the movie as well, he's got like a goatee beard, which makes him look a lot less like Sean Connery than you would have expected. Now, why they dubbed over him, it's not really clear, but apparently he might have been poorly when they were doing dubbing, and so he wasn't able to complete it. But it completely, it completely negates the point of having him in the film in the first place.
Yeah.
But the film is full of Bond references. Like I said, the very start of the film has this sort of title sequence on a boat, which isn't very Bondy, but then it cuts to this bit where they're projecting a film onto a woman's back, very much like they do in, you know, the title sequence of Dr. No, of From Russia With Love and Goldfinger. So they're projecting a film onto a woman's back. And there are things like remote control vehicles, all sorts of stuff. It does do a lot of Bond references, but obviously it's trying very carefully not to get sued by Cubby and Harry at this point. No one ever says James Bond or 007. And interestingly, Neil Connery's character is actually called Dr. Neil Connery, and Lois Maxwell's character is called Lois Maxwell. So they did a lot of work on the script. But Mr. At one point, Adolfo Celli, he's talking to Bernard Lee's character, and he says he's enlisted the aid of that young Scottish doctor, you know, the brother of secret agent 00, and that's as close as they get.
Oh.
Yeah. So, like I said, the director, Alberto Demartino, he said that they had approached Sean Connery, who said he got so angry when he was approached that he literally kicked me up the backside. But Lois Maxwell, she enjoyed being in the movie. She's really good in it. She gets to do a lot more than she ever gets to do as Moneypenny. You get to see her having shooting a machine gun, all sorts of stuff. And she said that she earned more money from OK Connery than she had done for her combined appearances in all the James Bond films at that point. So they must have looked after her. And so in an interview in 1996, Lois Maxwell said that Sean Connery had, when he'd learned that she'd joined the cast of this film, got very angry with her and started screaming, "You have betrayed me." But they patched things up when apparently she was in a press conference with Neil Connery, and she sort of deflected a lot of the questions away from him, protected him from the press. And Sean Connery really, was very impressed by her from that. And that sort of mended their relationship. So this film was released around the world in 67 under different titles: Operation 007, Secret Agent 00, Operation Kid Brother, OK Connery. And Neil Connery, to be fair, isn't bad in it. It's a passable performance considering he's a plasterer and he's never done any acting before. But it's really shoddily made. And what I did think was funny at one point is that Connery wears some like Never Say Never Again style dungarees at one point. It's a nice little link there. It has been covered on the Mystery Science Theatre 3000, which it's not a concept I really fully understand well. Have you ever seen that?
No.
It's like an American thing where they play bad, hokey old movies and they have like characters commenting over it. I think it's quite popular in America. It's never translated to the UK, but they did an episode on it anyway.
Right.
But talking about Neil Connery, he did do a couple more movies. He starred in a movie called The Body Stealers in 1969. And he did a couple more British things, one called Only When I Laugh in 1980 and a Bond spoof in a Chinese comedy, Aces Go Places 3 in 1984. But yeah, it's a real oddity. You can watch it on YouTube, not in great quality. And I think it's available on Prime internationally, but not in the UK. But I mean, it's a curio more than anything. But lots of interesting links, I think, to the Bond world.
Hmm. Where's it go in your ranking?
What's that?
Where'd you put it in your ranking?
it's very similar to Casino Royale 67, actually, right. But obviously doesn't have the high caliber stars like Peter Sellers and what have you. So it's got to go below there. I'm not putting in the rankings. But yeah, Neil Connery sadly died not long after his brother Sean. He died in May 2021, aged 82. He'd had cancer. So yeah, but OK Connery. One to seek out if you're a hardcore completist.
Nah. O is for Onatopp, Xenia Onatopp. So Xenia Onatopp is an ex-Soviet pilot, and she is in the film GoldenEye. She is a really sort of force to be reckoned with, and you know, very strong, very sort of got a real sexual energy about her. I don't want to come across as creepy, but that's
rubbing your thighs,
yeah, yeah. But that's genuinely what, you know, it's quite a threatening sexual energy, and she gets a lot of satisfaction from the way she kills people as well. And a method of killing is crushing men between her thighs, which we see her do pretty early on. But before that, she is in a car chase with Bond. Bond's driving the DB5 down the Twisty Mountains. I can't remember where it was filmed. Was it Switzerland?
Monte Carlo?
It's on the way to Monte Carlo, isn't it?
Yeah. Right.
In the film, yeah. And she's in a red Ferrari, and they have a bit of a play with the chase. Then she meets him in the casino, and this
great
is where
exchange.
She... Yes, it is, yeah. And they've got a bit of chemistry right off the bat, haven't they? Even from that car chase, they have chemistry, which is impressive. Yeah. But she kills Admiral Chuck Farrell in order to steal his identity. And that's what she does. She crushes him between her thighs and really looks like she's enjoying it when she does so. She kidnaps Natalia when they get to St. Petersburg. And that's to try and lure Bond, isn't it? That's the point of that. They have that famous steam room, you know, Bond and Xenia. They have the steam room fight, which when they shot that, they padded out the room and just told the actors to go for it and just really thrash each other around the room, which is what they did. So when Bond rescues Natalia, she's then recaptured by Xenia. Is she tied on the train track?
Who?
Natalia.
They're laid across the track, I think, aren't
they? That's it, yeah. Yeah. So Xenia then goes to Cuba with Trevelyan. Natalia escapes with Bond. And then when they're in Cuba, they meet again. And this is where Xenia falls to her death. The weight of the helicopter drags her against branches of a tree, and it crushes her in a sort of how she kills people. She's just the same as happened to her. It's quite a fitting death, really.
Yes.
But, I mean, in terms of henchmen, she's up there as well, to be honest. Another great henchman.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, we had an odd job and now we've got Onatopp. And I think Onatopp is not only one of the great hench people, she's also one of the great Bond girls as well, isn't he? She sort of straddles that.
Absolutely.
Two great cornerstones of the Bond franchise. And yeah. Yeah, that death, you mentioned the death of the Canadian, a general at the start. But
Chuck Farrell, yeah.
Chuck Farrell. And I can just see, you mentioned it, I can just see his face. And
purple, his purple face, bulging eyes, yeah. Isn't it?
And he's smiling through it as well, isn't he? Yeah. He's loving it. And the way that she sort of, the way that she's enjoying it as well. And I love the bit where they get to Servania and she's machine gunning people and just enjoying machine gunning people.
Mm.
Just so sinister and brutal, but she's just one of the many reasons I love that movie, I think.
Excellent. Yeah, great performance. And played by Famke Janssen, who is a Dutch actor born 1964. Famous for, so other roles include Jean Grey in the X-Men series. She was very good in that, actually.
Very good, one of
the, yeah. She was in Nip Tuck. She played Lenore Mills in the Taken trilogy.
Right.
She gets taken in the second one.
Well, who?
It's daughter in the first, then it's her, right. And then the third one, no one gets taken. It's just him running, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. In 2008, she was made a Goodwill Ambassador for Integrity by the UN. Other roles, we've got Hemlock Grove. Have you seen that? Netflix original.
Is it about werewolves?
It's werewolves, maybe vampires, that sort of thing.
Not seen it.
She was in How to Get Away with Murder. Not seen that either. But she said about the role of Xenia, she said, "My dad was a big lover of the Bond films, so seeing how the women had been and how they'd been portrayed, I also saw that it's tongue-in-cheek, that entire franchise. So from all that history of what I'd learned over the time of watching those movies, that kind of came up a bit with Xenia on the top and who she was, and that she would be a stronger kind of Bond woman, but that it needed to be tongue-in-cheek in a way." And I think she pulled it off. If that's, you know, she went in with that mindset, she absolutely pulled it off. And there aren't many more, if you talk about the modern era of Bond, I can't think of one who really comes close that does what she does.
No, especially not in the on the villain side. Or I think GoldenEye does have a couple of great Bond girls, doesn't it? I think Natalia's pretty good.
Yeah.
I wonder whether it's a Martin Campbell thing, because obviously you've got Eva Green, who then sort of redefined or defined what we think of Bond girls for the next iteration of Bond, didn't we? But yeah, she's just terrific. I can't speak highly enough of On the Top.
Absolutely, and she's one of the characters that you can't take your eyes off the screen when she's on.
Great costuming as well.
Yeah.
Matching the car that she gets at the start. And then also, what a name. Just like a great Bond character name. It could have been plucked from Fleming, right?
Yeah, definitely.
I believe it must be brand new, right, from the writers.
Yeah.
I mean, is On the Top even a real surname? If your name is On the Top, please email the show and let us know that it is a real name and not just something made up by a schoolboy, a James Bond character.
So there we go. Xenia On the Top.
Coffee? Medium sweet. Two medium sweet.
Thanks for listening. We hope you're enjoying the James Bond A to Z podcast. Remember, if you want to support the show, we have a coffee page at ko-fi.com/JamesBondA to Z, where you can buy us a coffee for just £3 or for £3 a month. Thanks for listening. Back to the show.
Is that all it does?
O is for Orlov, General Orlov. Now, General Orlov is one of the villains of Octopussy, played by Stephen Burkoff. And we'll do Orlov and Octopussy very soon in much more detail, but here's a little bit of a summary. So Orlov is a high-ranking, highly decorated general, Soviet general, with a seat on the Supreme Committee. And he's obsessed with the idea that invading Western Europe is the only way to demonstrate the Soviet Union's strength and power. His plan is to set off a nuclear bomb on the US Air Force base in West Germany, hoping that the US will withdraw forces from Europe and leave the West unprotected. But he works. It's so complicated, but he's working with Kamal Khan to smuggle the bomb across the borders. But he does get shot at the borders when he is trying to follow the train which had the bomb on board, and he gets a decent enough villain death. He has that line about being a Soviet hero in the morning. Little does he know that his plot is going to be foiled by James Bond dressed as a clown. So Roger Moore had actually worked with Stephen Burkoff on The Saint many years before. And on the audio commentary for Octopussy, he calls Stephen Burkoff a very inventive actor. And he also says, in the nicest way, he can really chew the scenery. He's a larger-than-life character. And that is, I think, a polite way of Roger Moore saying that Stephen Berkoff is a bit of a maniac thespian. That's generally the reputation that he's got. His performance in Octopussy is over the top. I mean, it's perfect for Bond. But Stephen Berkoff said that he thought that John Glenn had curbed some of his excesses. So if it was even more excessive than what we get in Octopussy, well, that would have been quite something. Berkoff doesn't do many interviews, so he hasn't talked much about being General Orlov. But in a 2018 interview, he said that he liked playing villains. He says, "I like evil people. I'm like a surgeon who is happiest when working with a very diseased body." But yeah, just a little bit about Stephen Berkoff. He was born Leslie Stephen Burks on in August 1937 in Stepney in the East End of London, and his family were Jewish immigrants whose family name was originally Berkowitz. His father anglicised it to Burks, and then later Stephen Berkoff changed his surname to Berkoff and started using his middle name rather than Leslie. His family had emigrated to America after World War II, but they returned to England after his father failed to find work. But Berkoff's acting began with theatre training in a repertory company in Barrow-in-Furness in the 1960s. And since then, he's basically worked very, very extensively in the theatre. He's a playwright, he's a director, he's an actor, he's a writer. And his role in Octopussy launched quite a successful career for him, often playing villains in Hollywood movies. So he next appeared in Beverly Hills Cop. He was also in Rambo First Blood Part 2 as the villain. But he also appeared in Clockwork Orange and Barry Lyndon. So he's got some great credits to his name. He also appeared opposite Daniel Craig in the 2011 adaptation of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, playing the attorney to Christopher Plummer's character. So I thought that was interesting. Mm. On TV, he's done loads of TV work. He's appeared in Deep Space Nine, Children of Dune, Space Precinct, and of course, Doctor Who. Mm. More recently, he's appeared in Vikings as well. I would say the most famous thing for me beyond Octopussy for Stephen Berkoff is when he got pranked by Brass Eye. Do you remember this?
Which one was it?
So Brass Eye, for anyone who hasn't listened, is a satirical news program which written by Chris Morris that had a lot of it did a lot of pranks on celebrities, sort of skewering the pomposity and like getting celebrities to get involved in campaigns for things that were patently not real. One of them famously being a drug called Cake, which was this giant yellow tablet. But the one Stephen Berkoff got done for was he was warning people against the dangers of heavy electricity. And he stood in front of like a model pylons and he's got like a mallet and he's using this mallet to smash people and he's warning them like about heavy electricity. So he got really badly pranked, but it's very funny. But yeah, I mean, that's all I've got on Orlov, really. We'll cover him in some more detail on Octopussy. But I also just wanted to give a shout out, because we haven't got him on this episode, but to General Urimov, played by Godfrey John in GoldenEye. He was a renowned German actor. He worked a lot with Fassbinder. And I think he's terrific in GoldenEye. So apologies, Urimov, but Orlov, He got the nod on this episode rather than yourself. But Godfrey John, great actor. That said, he died in 2014. But another great addition.
Absolutely. So now in a strange slot, O is for the Oscars.
Ooh.
Yes.
Academy Awards.
Yeah, the Academy Awards. So the first thing I'm going to start off is I'm going to tell you that there are five Bond films that have won Academy Awards.
Ooh.
Can you name them?
Well, I'll start from the most recent, because No Time to Die, Spectre and Skyfall all won Oscars.
Yes.
For best song.
Yeah.
I think the other two are, I'm going to say, Thunderball and Goldfinger.
Oh, it's ingrained in your mind, isn't it?
Yes. Did I get it right?
You got it right, yeah. So yes. Best sound effects, Goldfinger. Best special visual effects, Thunderball. And then Skyfall won Best Original Song and Best Sound Editing. And then Best Original Song for Spectre and No Time to Die. So, yeah, it's on a very good run at the moment of Best Original Songs. It's had a few nominations along the way as well. Original Score, Best Sound, Dimes Are Forever, Best Song, Live and Let Die, Best Art Direction, The Spy Who Loved Me. And The Spy Who Loved Me got three nominations. It got a Best Original Score, Best Original Song. Moonraker.
A big year.
It was. Sadly, it didn't win because, you know, I think the art direction for Spy Who Loved Me, you know, the work that Ken Adam, Peter Lamont did on that,
is
incredible. But 1980, also Moonraker got nominated for the visual effects, which we mentioned in the Moonraker episode. The For Your Eyes Only song got nominated. And then more recently, you've seen Skyfall really did well in terms of nominations. Best Cinematography, Best Original Score, Best Sound Mixing, and then of course it won two. And then No Time to Die was nominated for Best Sound and Best Visual Effects as well. So, I mean, it's never going to be one that cleans up at the awards, but just the fact that it's there and, you know, it's getting nominated and it has got some wins is impressive.
Yeah, I think there's... I see conversations where it's like they're in the Daniel Craig era, they've really chased the Oscar success, the Oscar glory. Mm. But the Bond films are in contention for Oscars from like...
all the way, every decade.
Goldfinger onwards. So I think that's a little bit disingenuous. Yeah, I mean, yeah, they want the prestige of the Academy Awards, but they've always been in contention because they've always made quality movies, haven't they?
Mm. Yeah. So who's the only Bond actor to win an Oscar?
Oh, but it's got to be Connery, hasn't it?
It's Connery. Do you know the role?
Untouchables.
Yes. You have to. Yeah. Have you learned this? Have you done your homework?
I've been doing my homework now. This is...
And then you've got some Bond alumni that have won Academy Awards as well. So Christopher Walken, he got it for The Deer Hunter. Judy Dench, who we covered, she won it for her, I think, 8 minutes on screen in Shakespeare in Love.
Yeah.
Halle Berry, of course, won it while she was shooting on Die Another Day. She won Best Actress for Monsters Ball. Javier Bardem, he won Best Supporting Actor for No Country for Old Men. Christoph Waltz has won two, Best Supporting Actor for Inglourious Basterds and Django Unchained. Rami Malek in 2019 for Bohemian Rhapsody, and Benicio del Toro also for Traffic. He won Best Supporting Actor in 2001. So yeah, it's not shy of having some decent Academy Award winners on their books either.
I guess going back to my point about chasing awards
more recently
they've been able to attract a better caliber of people, haven't they? You see those names of Oscar winners are more recent, really. I think it wasn't Walken. Is he the only villain to have played a Bond actor to have played a Bond? He was the first actor to have played a Bond villain that was an Oscar winner, I think.
Yeah, because he was already he'd already won it when he played Zorin.
Yeah.
But then obviously Christoph Waltz, he'd won the Academy Awards when he played Blofeld.
And then so. Rami Malek as well, hadn't he? So,
And in terms of directors, so we've only had one that won the Best Director. Do you know who it is?
Oh, what, a Bond director who won Best Director? Is it Sam Mendes?
Sam Mendes for American Beauty, in 1999. But we nearly got two because Danny Boyle, of course, won it for Slumdog Millionaire in 2008.
Yeah, very true.
In 1982, they actually recognised Cubby Broccoli and they awarded him the Irving G. Thalberg Memorial Award for his excellence in the industry.
Yeah.
And then more recently, they did a special to celebrate 60 years of Bond, which was so weird because it was presented by skateboarder Tony Hawk, snowboarder Shaun White and surfer Kelly Slater. And then they presented this montage, which was set to the Live and Let Die.
Even though Billie Eilish was there singing No Time to Die.
And Judi Dench was there. It's just...
And Lazenby lives in LA. as does Piers Brosnan.
Honestly, it's so bizarre, isn't it? Like, but you know, it's recognition, isn't it? That's the main thing, I guess.
Is it? And that was the year that they did the For Your Eyes Only stage production, isn't it? When he got the Irving Thalberg.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And that's quite something to watch if you've seen it. That's got Harold Sakato. I think Richard Keel as well is an actor playing James Bond. There's a whole action sequence. It's a bizarre moment, but they should do more stuff like that, to be honest.
Yeah, with skateboarders.
But with the skateboarders, yeah. Or free runners, yeah. What do you think? I'm not a huge Oscars fan. I mean, I've covered them professionally for quite a long time. I don't feel like they really mean a great deal, but I guess it does add prestige to your picture if you win one.
Yeah, but I just think the way it's chosen and the way the winners are chosen, it's not that exciting anymore, is it? You can normally predict the normal three or four films that are going to sweep the awards. So it's, I don't know.
It seems to me not really very meritocracy.
It's not a meritocracy, no.
Meritocracy, yeah. It's more of a popularity contest sometimes, isn't it? Who's got the money to campaign? And the fact that the Bond films have won three songs in a row, that surprises me. It seems like now they release the song and they go on to win. I don't know how they judge what the best original song is for a movie.
Well, that's the other issue, isn't it? How are these being picked? You know, it's not like an Olympics where you've got tangible, you know, you've got times and stuff to go by. This is just sort of the opinion of, you know, a few people.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there'll be plenty more Oscar success down the line for the Bond films. But I think, like, you know, winning for technical awards, sound and visual effects is a noble victory, I think, for those early Bond films.
Absolutely, and I think those are the thing. Those are the awards that should be looked at with more prestige than the big, you know, the big five or six that everyone talks about. I think the ones where that is about the craft, I think they're much more valid.
Yeah, look at June. You know, that cleared up at the Oscars, didn't it? Another Bond direct contender, Denis Villeneuve.
Yeah,
I didn't do No Time to Die because he was doing June. I think he made the right decision, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Right, on to the last section. And this is O is for O'Toole. Plenty O'Toole. And played by Lana Wood in Diamonds Are Forever. We covered Plenty O'Toole in our Diamonds Are Forever episode. So you can go back to that one. But yeah, worth saying that she's not on screen very much in Diamonds Are Forever. I think she only gets a few scenes. She's quite memorable.
Yeah, in the casino, she gets thrown in the pool.
Yeah. And they get the great line, you know, Plenty O'Toole, named after your father, which is a great Connery one-liner. But so Lana Wood was born Svetlana Lisa Gurdin in 1946. Her parents were Russian immigrants, and her older sister was Natalie Wood, and we'll come on to her in a minute. Her sister Natalie was born Natasha Gurdin. And she took the stage name Natalie Wood on one of her first movies. So when Lana followed her into acting, and her first movie role was in The Searchers with John Wayne, they asked her what they wanted her stage name to be, and they chose her sister's. So it was Lana Wood to her sister's Natalie Wood. And their sisters actually appeared in a lot of films together. But Lana Wood's career really took off in the 1960s. She appeared in a drama series called The Long Hot Summer. And then she landed a role in a soap opera called Peyton Place. She got the call for Diamonds Are Forever, which obviously was shooting in the USA, so was looking for American Bond girls. As her friend, she was friends with Tom Mankiewicz, who was writing the script. And preparing her for the audition, he told her to wear high heels and try to look tall. She was originally in the frame to play Tiffany Case. I don't know if you remember this story from Diamonds Are Forever, but she was lined up to play Tiffany Case, but lost out to Jill St. John when she came on the scene. And there's a bit of a sort of a shady story behind that, in that there was a lawyer called Sidney Korshak who basically strong-armed the production into casting Jill St. John as Tiffany Case. but worth revisiting the Diamonds Are Forever episode if you want to learn more about that. But talking about the director Guy Hamilton, Lana Wood said, "Guy was very easygoing. The first day I cornered him and said, 'This is what I see about Plenty. This is the problem that I have. I don't want her to come off as a heavy or someone manipulative. I want her to speak in a higher voice. I want to make her very sweet, very honest, very empty-headed. And I tried to mimic Lee Taylor Young and Minnie Mouse. I needed that type of lilting voice. I wanted her to come off as very ingenious. It was a choice." And Hamilton basically said, "Lana, do whatever you want." So, she'd obviously put a lot of thought into it. She's talked about this quite a lot at length in past, that she had an affair on set with Sean Connery, as did Jill St. John, despite Lana Wood, she, at the time, was in a relationship with the lyricist Leslie Bricus. And so this sort of affair with Connery was short-lived. She said, "We actually started having an affair before filming began, but we kept it secret. Neither of us was married at the time, but it still isn't done to be public about it. I remember being very embarrassed when we had to do the love scenes because we were trying not to let people know. You want to be a good actress, but for it not to seem too convincing." She said, "Sean was a combination of a rough, tough guy and a charmer, a ladies' man." So, it was all happening on Diamonds Are Forever.
Yeah, well, they're told to do what she wants. So, yeah.
There are, like you mentioned, there is a scene where Plenty O'Toole gets thrown out the window into the pool. And there was another scene that she shot, but didn't get cut. It didn't get make it into the final film. And she was quite annoyed about that because she was being thrown into this pool at like 3 o'clock in the morning. And she kept having to be like having her hair and makeup redone when they wanted to do other takes. And when she went to see the movie, she said, "A lot of my scenes were cut. I didn't know it until I saw the film. I felt like I bent over to pick up my popcorn and Plenty was dead. I was not a happy camper. I recall thinking, is this what I've travelled all over the world promoting? I was devastated." She said, "There was plenty more of Plenty, but we didn't get to see it." After Diamonds Are Forever, she said that she did suffer a bit with being stereotyped. She said she thought it would open more doors, but in fact, it didn't open any doors at all. All I was offered was sex pot roles, and you can't be doing those forever. I did suffer from being stereotyped. Now, sadly, Lana's life in the future would become dominated by the death of her sister Natalie Wood. Do you know this story?
No.
So her older sister Natalie, she was found drowned at sea on November the 29th, 1981, while she was on a boating holiday with Robert Wagner and their friend Christopher Walken. Second mention of Christopher Walken. Now, Robert Wagner is now married to Jill St. John. So it's a weird connection between the two of them. But there's been suspicions that there's foul play involved with the death of Natalie Wood. It's never really been explained how she fell into the water, why she drowned, why she wasn't rescued. And so Lana Wood has been campaigning ever since to try and get to the bottom of the truth of what happened. She said, "I don't believe it was premeditated, but that doesn't mean I don't think he did it. Of course he did it." And she's talking about Robert Wagner, to be clear, not Christopher Walken. And Christopher Walken doesn't really talk about the incident and hasn't really spoken about it since 1997. And he just said, "You know, I didn't see anything. It's nothing to do with me. It was a very sad situation. That's it. Just, I don't want to be asked about it again." So he doesn't talk about it. But in 2018... a retired detective declared that Robert Wagner was a person of interest in the death of Natalie Wood. And he made the decision after interviewing lots of witnesses who claimed to have seen Wagner and Natalie Wood arguing on the boat before her disappearance. But earlier this year in 2022, after years of investigation, the LA County Sheriff's Department cleared Robert Wagner of any wrongdoing in the death of Natalie Wood. So that is basically the end of that story. Very, very sad story that's sort of dominated the sisters' lives, but an interesting one. So just talking about Plenty O'Toole again, just to bring it back to Bond, she said, "For a long time, I thought I'd made a mistake with the character, but no longer. Now when my life revolves around looking after my grandchildren, if I get a Bond-related invite, I jump at the chance." So there you go. That's Lana Wood, Plenty O'Toole.
Hmm.
So I think we've covered a lot of ground in today's episode.
We have. Yeah, so let us know your underappreciated Bond moments. If there's one that really jumps out of you? Have you got any that jump out?
Plenty of Tool being thrown out the window.
Yeah. So it is a great, great moment.
It's a great gag, and I didn't realise there was a pool there.
Yeah. There's quite a few in Diamonds Are Forever, you know, little pieces. I do like the car going up the wall. So if you've got stuff like that, a little underappreciated stuff from the 60 years of Bond, then do let us know. You can email us on podcast@jamesbond8z.co.uk or on the socials @jamesbond8z on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter.
Yeah, email us your thoughts as an audio file if you can. MP3 is fine. Whatever your phone records at, or if you've got a microphone, even better. Keep it under 2 minutes. Make sure you include your name and your underappreciated moment and why you've chosen it. And we'll include those in our 60th anniversary episode in October. So our next episode will be a special on the 1983 Roger Moore film Octopussy. That's one to look forward to. Big episode. And we'll have a special guest joining Brendan and I for that. So yeah, thanks for listening to the podcast. If you want to support the show, you can buy us a coffee on ko-fi.com/JamesBond8Z. Cost you less than the price of a pint of beer, but it will bring a big smile to our faces and help us to keep the show going. Or you can buy a t-shirt in the show notes. We'll send you in the right direction to buy one of those. But without further ado, it's time to say that the James Bond A to Z podcast will return next week.
Ciao.
Are you going to say something funny for Wheatley's exit? What would he say? Bye. Cheery bye.
Tatty ho.
Tatty. Yeah, something like that. Anyway. Thanks for listening.
The James Bond A to Z podcast features Tom Butler, Brendan Duffy, and Tom Wheatley. The podcast was produced by Tom Wheatley, with music by Tom Ingemels, and artwork supplied by Helen Dolly.
Hi, I'm Plenty.
But of course you are.
Plenty O'Toole.
Named after your father, perhaps?